This is tape number 9, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor of English Thomas Schaub, December 21st, 2006. Tom, when we stopped yesterday, we were still going through your first stint as chair, and you had covered a number of issues, and we were just approaching the one of salary, the decisions that you had to make, and I was asking you if there are issues of retribution.
Yes, well, let me first say that salary is a contentious issue. The chair has always set salary in the English department. Other departments do it differently. Sometimes there are salary committees or there are recommendations made. Sometimes I gather that some departments actually work it out together somehow, and everything's done in public. But the system is a merit system. So it's very difficult to use the yearly merit allocated by the state legislature to pick up somebody's salary from where it should, to bring it along to where it should be. You know, you really have to spend almost all of that money, whatever it amounts to. Sometimes it's very often, it's very little. But you have to do it to award merit. And merit is usually almost always awarded in the year that something is published. So if you have a book and a couple of articles and you're teaching, scores and commentary are excellent, and you're a good department citizen, and you're on committees at the department or at the university level, you're going to get high merit. When I first started, in fact, the university, the college had a system where they would send out somewhat well before the actual decisions had to be made, a request for a identification of faculty by a number of categories. High merit, medium high, medium, medium low, and low. And so you had already sort of done that sort of crude division of your faculty into one or more of those levels. And they, to get low merit, didn't necessarily at all mean that you were not as important a faculty member. It just meant that you hadn't, that hadn't been a year where a lot of your stuff had come out.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So, and there are ways to sort of regularize this. At one point, and I think it was in that first stint as chair, the state came out with a stipulation that people who are doing their job should get average merit. So if they're teaching well, they're working on a book, and they're serving the university in a number of ways, and under which we put them under the category of service, those are the three categories. Research, teaching, and service. And at this university, you know, we're able to hire the best people in the country, and occasionally we draw from outside the nation, but usually overwhelmingly we draw our faculty from universities in this country. And it's been my view, and I think it's the view of many, that particularly in the humanities, I can't speak for the sciences, but we don't have to, teaching or research is not an either or for us. So, you know, we think that that we should be able to expect that everyone will be an above average teacher, and that the real weight of the merit falls on research, because we're a research one university. If we are Now, I don't know that all my colleagues would agree to this, but certainly the view of most of the chairs with whom I spoke and of the dean, the deans that I worked with during my 6 years, that the weighting would be, you know, the teaching would come first and that research would come first and the teaching would get a somewhat lesser weighting. So it might be, if you were distributing 1% merit, 60% might be research, teaching might be 30%, service might be 10%. Mm-hmm. I never said this to anyone, but I kind of felt that pretty absolutely that your teaching ought to be more than competent. It ought to be good. It should be good teaching, above average teaching, and that if it was below that, it almost like almost deserving of demerit. So, in the way in which I was trained by the former chair, Joe Wiesenforth, and by the advice, and you know, when you get this salary, this merit package, there's a whole set of directions that goes along with it. So you're not really working out there as a maverick, you know. And Wiesenforth showed me that he worked with a set of 5x8 cards, and you go through each person's CV. You go through it, what's called every year, you fill out an activities report, and you put down what you published, what is in publication, that is, it's in process, it's been accepted for publication. So you have, you know, different categories. What have you published this year? What came out this year? What's been accepted for publication? What major projects are you working on? What papers did you give? What articles have you submitted that have been accepted? That kind of thing. So number of categories having to do with research. And then there's a section of the activities report that deals with your teaching. You know, what were your scores? What new courses did you invent and get on the books? How many independent studies? Let's see, what else? Graduate students, how many dissertators? Yeah. How many dissertation committees are you on? How many preliminary committees did you help to write and grade, and master's exams? And so there's all of that sort of teaching thing. And then you list the committees that you served on and whether you were chair or not. And the committees were, the service then was department committees, university committees, and professional service. And that would include writing tenure reviews for people at other universities, serving on boards of literary journals, being a reader for other journals, or for presses. So, and that can be time consuming and is really a variant in a way of, it's called professional service, but it's also a kind of service that provides an indication of your stature in the field. If you're being asked all the time whether or not this piece it should be published in American Literature or PMLA or American Quarterly, that tells you something about that person's stature. So all of this gets kind of coded. So you write down on the card research, teaching, and service. And you kind of notate it. So you could say, on the research, say one book, two articles, another book, expected next year or year after next, and then you put down high, so high merit for research, and then teaching, you put down, you know, high or medium or low, whatever that, you know, you look at the evaluation scores. And I looked at, I don't know that all chairs do this, but I always went into the files and looked at the student evaluation to see what they wrote on the back of the computer evaluation forms. Yeah. So that is a very time-consuming thing. But you know, you want to have a certain confidence in the decisions that you're making, mm-hmm. obviously. And you want to be able to say, well, this is what I did, this is my process. So eventually you end up with a card for each faculty member.
Tom, a question. Do you get into shading the evaluation? And by that I mean, does one publication in a particularly significant journal, is that worth three publications in lesser journals, or is that too much?
It's not too much, though it is you raise a provocative point, because different chairs have different expertise, and they may not recognize what is the flagship journal in linguistics or in composition and rhetoric. But you know, as you fairly readily in the first year or so, it seemed to me that, partly because I hired a linguist my first year, I got to know, what journals were prestigious and what, mm-hmm. Because that kind of recognition is important. For example, at the level of tenuring, so you can publish a whole lot in fly-by-night journals, and it won't impress the divisional committee very much. But if you're in American literature and you've published in American literature, American Quarterly, Critical Inquiry, mm-hmm. American literature, what have you, that means something, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I do take note of that. And at least I did take note of that. And there's also a question of, everybody has a different way of representing themselves, and we try to insist as chairs that people use a uniform format. Some colleagues are quite good about this. So they'll say, single-authored books will be one category they'll have on their CV. Mm-hmm. And then they'll have co-authored books, or they'll have a co-authored article. And they'll list, the first person listed is the one who did most of the work. They'll list their name accordingly. They'll have a category on their CV or their activity report for articles. And then they have another category for notes and miscellaneous pieces. So they themselves make the distinction. Well, here's a full-blown 25, 35-page essay that I had published in PMLA, and here's a little five-page note that I wrote for, studies in the novel or something. That's the rarity, actually. Most people will say, well, this is another article. But, of course, most chairs will... do you want to stop and get some water? So, yes, there is that kind of shading that goes on. Mm-hmm. The chair is going to recognize that this was a very small little note, or not a full-blown, contribution, really. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things I would note. I'd say, two articles, 125, 1-4, one in American literature, or one in ELH, or Renaissance studies, something really top notch. You would certainly know whether they appeared in referee journals or not. Uh-huh. That was the method, and I shared the method with everyone. There were always those who, in my opinion, just never quite got it. They would say, no one ever complained to me in my whole 3 years.
Really?
I got no complaints.
I think that's incredible.
Yeah. And but it was apparent from discussions that took place at the beginning of every year, that there was some disgruntlement about the merit process. Because every year the chair is, a motion is made to give the chair the ability to do this, to give the chair the power. So the power is bestowed yearly. There are a number of things that like that, to appoint honorary scholars and that kind of thing that the faculty doesn't want to be bothered with. It's a fairly regular occurrence, almost a yearly occurrence, that somebody raises her hand or his hand and says, you know, in history they do it differently, or somebody else will raise a hand and say, you know, I just don't know where I stand. I don't really understand why I got what I got or what it means, I used to explain, well, I basically study everybody's activities for the past year, and I put them in order from highest to lowest. And it doesn't matter, it doesn't mean that you're a better or worse colleague, it just means that you had a good year, mm-hmm. if you got high merit. And there is attention paid to, say, when you publish a book, why, there should be a recognition of that book for at least three cycles. So usually, you know, when the book's accepted, then when it's published, and then maybe another year where you get credit for having published something of that, you know, that takes a while. It usually takes 4 to 6 years to write a book. Mm-hmm. And we explain these things, and it just doesn't sink in for some people. So one thing that I did after that first year was to make up a sheet in which I laundered it of names, of course, but I put at the top, you know, the highest ranking people, the highest ranking performances. So let's see, here's the number of people who published a book last year. It might be six. Number of people who did this, number of people who did that, and then I would have a teaching section, you know, and give all, you know, that the evaluation scores went all the way from 4 down to, you know, whatever, 2.3, and then the service load, the heavy load of the associate chair, for example, that has to be recognized, or the people who serve on committees that meet at least once a month and do quite a bit of work, like special nominations and the advisory committee. And I thought, you know, I passed that on. I said, you know, you should be able to see where on this graph you would fit and why you got what you got. Well,
this is a lot of work.
It's a ton of work. It's usually, almost a couple hours a day for about 3 months. You know, you're really working on it. Uh-huh. But anybody who does it really ends up feeling that it's pretty clear cut, you know? But it's pretty obvious that some people deserve, you know, if the merit handed down by... Oh, and the other thing is, you see, is the logic of it, that if average merit that year is 4%, and somebody comes out with a book, well, they should get more than average merit. Right? So it should mm-hmm. be something above 4%. Mm-hmm. Well, that means that there's less money in the pool. Somebody's going to get less than 4%. Mm-hmm. Now, this was something that I proposed. This brings me to something that I proposed, that the somewhat subjective element in all of this, in addition to the way in which I analyzed the activity reports, though it's, you know, I don't think of that as being very subjective. You have, this is what you've done this year, and you can usually say, well, this person did more than anybody else, or these three people, these four people, just kicked out the jams in all areas, mm-hmm. which is not uncommon, by the way. I found that, in the English department, it was usually the case,
really?
Rather than unusual. It was usually the case that the people who published the most had the best teaching scores and did the most service.
Hmm.
You know, this idea that, well, all he does is write books, you know, and he stays in his carrel and he doesn't pay any attention to his teaching and all that. It's not true. People who want to succeed and have a, you know, have a sense of excellence want to be hitting on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. They just can't help themselves.
Yes.
You know? And there are those who, you know, I can think of one or two maybe that you could say, well, his teaching's pretty good. I don't see him on many committees. He's always at the department and executive committees, though. He always meets in, you know, what do we say, meets together with the department and has a terrific research record. But for the most part, you know, you think of people like Susan Friedman or Ron Wallace, Joe Wiesenfarth. You know, these people are superb teachers. Mm-hmm. Heather Dubrow, superb teacher. And they publish a book about every 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's like clockwork. And articles in between. And they're flying all around the world and giving talks at universities in Germany and Italy and China. And they're on all of the significant committees. You know, Susan Friedman and I were both, and I think Joe Wiesenfarth also, were at the same time that we were chair of the Humanities Divisional Committee, which dealt with tenure from all of the departments in the humanities across campus.
Were you chair of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so, in any case, the one area that I thought maybe the department would like to provide some input would be, well, if you have an average, what is the extent, what percentage of the average should go toward recognizing a book? Now, here's your major achievement in a department like English. Should it be no higher than, say, 20% above average? Should it be double? What should it be? And I always felt that in order to recognize that, as far as I could see, and I could see better than anyone else in the department, everybody was doing his or her job. You know, at one point I would say there was only maybe one person who wasn't pulling his weight.
Amazing.
Everybody did their job. They showed up and taught. They taught well. The English department has a very high student evaluation average or median. You know, if the 4 is excellent, we're up there around 3.3, 3.4. Students feel that they're getting well taught in English. I think, well, everybody's teaching. Everybody's doing their homework. Everybody's grading papers. Everybody's preparing for courses. Everybody's working on something. They all got a project in the hopper. And they're all doing whatever committee work has been assigned to them. Well, you know, you don't really want to give them a crummy raise.
Right.
So I can't remember exactly what. I had something like, I don't think, say with a 4% average raise, I probably never gave anything above a 6.5 or a 7% to the book people or to the people who published 2 books. I mean, sometimes, Howard Weinbrot this past year came out with, I think it was 2 books and a collection of essays all in the same year. Huh. You know, it's staggering. but of course, you're able to reward them in subsequent years.
Yeah.
So it adds up to a little bit more. If you're able to, I mean, you know, that year that you're planning to give someone another 2% above average, you might only have gotten 1% increase from the legislature, and the dean skims 0.25 off the top of that to help retain faculty and reward chairs and, mm-hmm. whatever else the dean does with that merit money. So it's far from perfect, but every time, and I took it to a vote, every time it came up, I said, well, let's talk about it. I appointed a salary committee. I did everything I could to try to ameliorate the misgivings of, I would say, probably no more than 5 or 6 faculty. They never passed. We get a motion and people just liked it just the way it was. And they felt that, you know, we get a different chair every 3 years, a different set of eyes, different set of values. And
it's so interesting.
Yeah. It's bothersome. You know, it's one of the things. Setting salary and hiring are the two things that you lose sleep over.
Yeah.
Especially when it gets down to, shall we make the offer to this person or to that person? Mm-hmm. You know, and you go over it and you read it and reread, and, you know, you just agonize over it, because at certain points in the year, the decision ends up being the chair's decision.
Tom, did colleagues ever lobby you for salary, or did they know that you had this system and there was no point in talking?
Well, everybody knew I had the system. But that didn't keep people from, in my opinion, as they should, from saying, look, I'm on the graduate research committee for the next 5 years. And that meets every Wednesday. I'm going to miss these meetings. But that means I have to interview a set of people every fall. I have to read all of their proposals. I have to make pitches to the graduate committee, research committee, every Wednesday. You know, it's a ton of work. And I hope I want that recognized, somebody might say. Or they'd have a book they just sent off. And they come in with the, their 450-page typescript and put it on your desk. When they submit their activity reports, there's a section where anything else that you'd like the chair to be aware of about your performance in the past year. Mm-hmm. And most people don't bother to say anything at that point, but some people will attach an article or say that they managed to learn how to use PowerPoint. They attached a web component to their course. And this was very time consuming, which it is. So everybody, probably, it's always a minority of people who make this effort, who try to get the chair's attention. I had people come in and say, well, you know, I've got 2 children in college now, and I feel like I'm publishing regularly, and I'm, you know, I've won a teaching award, and I don't really think that I'm compensated fairly. And they never really say it threateningly, like it's my fault, because it's not. It's, you know, it's the whole sequence of chairs since that person was hired. Plus the fact that, and it is a fact at this university, nobody would dispute it, there's wage compression at this university. Mm-hmm. So that the best paid people are the people who have just been hired. So, because we compete with everybody, we pay top dollar for the best people, mm-hmm. to get them here. But from that point on, they fall behind our peers, mm-hmm. And it bothers some people more than others. And we make go through gargantuan efforts to retain people, but the most underpaid people at Wisconsin, at least in the humanities, are the full professors. And then the associate professors and the assistant professors are about where they should be with their peers at Berkeley or Harvard or Michigan or what else have we got? North Carolina is in our peer group. Maybe UT Austin. So there's irritation about that. But they know that has to do with sort of the structure, the way it's set up at the university, and the amount of money coming from the legislature. It has more to do with that than it does with anything any particular chair is doing or not doing. Now, in my second year, in my second stint as chair, there was a catch-up, which there is periodically. It's too bad that the legislature can't regularize this somehow and just determine that they're going to keep us at the middle, or at least in the middle of our peer institutions. Mm-hmm. But we always fall down to the last or next to last. And enough pressure and rhetoric and enough people leave the university, as they are doing now. We're losing, one of my colleagues was sitting on the committee that that deals with compensation, and so it knows about the percentage of faculty who get outside offers and the percentage of those who leave. Mm-hmm. That's a majority now.
Really?
Yes.
That's a change, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So this builds up, and the legislature says, okay, it's time to, you know. So then we get a couple of years of 7%, 5% raises, and, so, and then sometimes also a catch-up. So there's a, like one year, it might have been my first or second year as chair the second time, there was a catch-up merit plus a market merit. And so departments were given their merit. If there was 7% merit, the dean would take his skim, and then the English department would get, say, 6.5% of its total salary pool. Mm-hmm. And that would be 6.5%, so that you could give everybody 6.5% raise if that were allowed, mm-hmm. which it is not. So that's the pool of money you get. That's your merit money. And then that year there was also, it was called a competitive raise, I think. And there were monies doled out to departments by the dean. And what mechanism he used, I don't know. But I remember having several tens of thousands of dollars to distribute to people who were severely, you know, salary compressed, and marketable, mm-hmm. people that you could lose. Mm-hmm. And I think they had that 2 years running. The first year, there were no limits on it. The second year, I put in for this one guy, and they said, you can't do this. He's over 60. Now, I don't know why.
This is side two of tape 9. Tom, you were talking about the faculty member who was 60.
Well, there was, I thought that this person had done consistently, day in and day out, was doing his research. Plus, he was directing one of the programs in the department. And he was making less than some of our assistant professors. And so I wanted to give him a second bump. I had given him a bump the year before, and I wanted to give him another bump. He would still be underpaid as a full professor, but it would make a noticeable difference in his paycheck. Well, they said, no, can't do that. They wanted people who are younger and competitive that might go on the market. And, you know, I didn't pursue it. I gave it to somebody else. But
and when you say they, you mean the dean's office?
It was either the dean's office or maybe the competitive compensation came out of, well, I suppose it did, must have come through the dean's office, but it probably came out of the chancellor's directives.
I see.
I'm guessing. I mean, I don't really know, but in any case, there are moments like that when suddenly your salary becomes much more reasonable, much more comparable to people around the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm not one that spends a lot of money, and you know, I tell you, Bob, I'm making a lot more than I ever thought I would make.
Really?
Oh, I didn't think of being a professor as being a as an occupation that would allow you to operate in the, say, upper middle class. I didn't think that. I have friends who got lower grades than I did in high school and college, much lower grades, who went into medicine and into law, mm-hmm. who are making, you know, $250,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Well, I just assume, well, that's the way it was. And maybe I am being paid what I thought I would be paid, and I'm just confused by the inflation mm-hmm. Over the years. But, you know, I think Wisconsin has been, you know, given its small tax base, I think it's been generous enough to me, as far as I'm concerned.
That's very interesting,
yeah.
Tom. You do not sit here in your office resentful, I take it.
I don't.
About what you're paid for the work that you do.
I don't. I mean, we've been bumping along here at zero raise, 1% raise, for a number of years now. I remember one year I did feel some irritation. It was when I was, might have been my first year as chair, when I just worked myself down to a nub at learning the job and teaching and doing contemporary literature and fighting off Lloyd Bitzer and, you know, all of that. I mean, I really worked my tail off. And my raise that year was 0.7%. And it was really, I thought, come on, you know, you got to do better than this, you know.
And your raise was set by the dean?
Yeah, the dean sets the chair's raise.
I see.
And so, you know, there are times like that when you feel that the legislature is, it just doesn't have a clue. But of course, as chair, you recognize that for ill or good, during the last 15 years, University of Wisconsin system has slipped in the ranking of top places that the state revenue goes. Mm-hmm. It's, number one is always redistributions to counties and mm-hmm. cities and stuff. But then number two, I think, used to be the UW system. And then it was either medical, Medicaid, or it was prisons. I'm not sure, but now prisons and Medicaid are both above the university. Mm-hmm. It's come down the ranking. So while the legislature would be correct in saying the amount of money you get from us each year has continued to go up, that percentage of state revenue has dropped precipitously from, I think it used to be as high as, you know, back in the 60s or 70s, it might have been as high as 24%. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's below 10%.
Is it that low now?
I think so. Again, you can't quote me as if I were the truth here, but I know for a fact that it was slipping. When I came in, I think it was at about 14%. And I remember David Ward saying that as recently as 1980, it had been 17%. So, you know, all our costs are going up. And so, you know, that percentage is the figure to watch. So if you're aware of that, and most of the faculty are aware of that, their irritation really tends to be visited not upon their chair or their salary committee, but with the state legislature. And the legislature, as I've been saying, comes around every 5 or 6, 7 years and gets into a panic and tries to get UW back up into the middle of the pack. Mm-hmm. And for people who put up with that, it works. And for those who don't, they leave. And very often it's the very best people that decide to move. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a much more humble attitude about what I do, and I don't think of myself as, I know you don't want me to say this, but I don't think of myself as being some sort of grand professor, some sort of brilliant scholar. But there are those who do think of themselves that way, and they deserve to think of themselves that way. There's a tremendously smart, ambitious, productive a group of people here on the faculty. Just tremendous. And I feel lucky to be working with them and taken seriously by them. And I've had people say to me, "Tommy, you don't know what you're talking about." But that's just my attitude about myself. You know, I just feel like I've published several books. I've got another one coming out. I've been chaired twice. But I don't, you know, I just don't feel like some sort of mein Herr professor, you know, German scholar. You know, it's not like I'm Immanuel Kant or somebody.
Although it is interesting, and I would say this for the record, a number of people, aside from my own interest in talking to you, said Tom Schaub is a major figure and you need to talk to him. So you do what you want with But you know, you're clearly one of the pillars of the department and a university citizen.
Yeah.
Question for you, when you're looking at salary, if you have somebody, for instance, who did not publish book or publications very much, but just had a hell of a year in community in service,
mm-hmm.
does that balance other things, or is service always the weak link?
There are rare but special cases where that person will come into the chair and say, "Look, I want to do work with X group off of campus, and I want to use that work not only because of my own values that I want to help these people, or I want to teach reading to X group, or I want to go to Milwaukee and work in their classrooms and so on, but it's also a an aspect of their research."
Oh.
Which is often the case or can be the case, not often, but as there are a number of researchers in the English department in the linguistics area and in the composition area who do research in high schools, junior highs, in Madison or Milwaukee, or I'm not sure all of the schools that they work with, but they build up videotape interviews. So in addition to doing work that they think is important, that's kind of outreach,
mm-hmm.
it's also contributing to the research. Now, if they just want to do outreach, and they're not hired as an outreach person, you know, you have a contract that tells you what you're hired to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can't get tenure doing something that you weren't hired to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you could if you did that thing well enough and it was actual research, but in general, they ask you to hew to the line. But what it might do is help make up for the lack of research production.
Oh, I see.
But it's not going to get you the same kind of, in my view, in a Research One university, you're not going to get the merit evaluation that you would have gotten had you published something. You know, I think that we are a humanities department, but we want to have the best people. We want them hitting on all cylinders, and we want a national reputation that is going to bring us the best students, undergrad and grad, and research is a big part of that.
Tom, you were commenting about the significance of research at a Research One university.
Well, one way of explaining that other than mere competitiveness and the kind of stature that the UW wants to have and the kind of students that you can draw with it. One way to think about it is that the experience I had when I went to conferences in the middle 80s, about a year or two after I'd published my first book, and people came up to me from, you know, South Carolina State or small colleges, and they would say, you know, your book on Pynchon is absolutely great. It's really helped me understand Pynchon and helped me teach Pynchon in the classroom. Or it's helped me in directing somebody's dissertation. So that, and I even had a PhD student write to me from a school he'd gotten a job in Western Kansas, and he said, you know, when I look at the books coming out, I see that, you know, that the books that I use are the books that are being written by my former teachers. Research One universities do the research and write the books, the essays and articles that are then made use of by other students and teachers around the world. And I'm still selling that book.
Are you?
It still sells, you know, a few copies a year, or sometimes 10. The sales will go up now that Pynchon's got a new novel out.
That's good.
I mean, you don't make much, you know. I mean, on that book, I might have made $3,000 total over a period of years. And it's not a way to make money unless you write a textbook. But a textbook that catches on in composition, say. So that's one way of understanding the rationale, the importance of research.
Tom, you worked very hard as chair. I mean, you spent, as the record now reflects, the various issues you dealt with. Why on earth would you do it again? How did that come about?
Well, I tell you, it's an interesting story. I'll try to be brief. That second year, I think it was 96 when I took over again. So it was, yeah, there was one in between me, Don Rowe, had a wonderful chairmanship. And then the only person willing to stand for the chair was a person that no one could stand. And I got people knocking on my door saying, you know, it's going to be a disaster if this guy takes over. This guy was one of the victim bullies that I described to you.
Yes.
And he was full of himself and arrogant and abrupt and petty and really quite negative about the department. I mean, it just, people could not imagine that he would turn around and become a good chair. It might have happened. He was certainly smart enough. And when you are a chair and you suddenly, at least I suddenly felt that my task was to defend and promote and develop my department. I no longer had any kind of private sense of self-interest at all. And I certainly didn't play favorites with anybody. I just didn't have any of those inclinations. And people felt that this person would. Well, why did I give in?
Yeah.
One was that I agreed with him about this other only candidate. And the other was that I had just gone through a divorce, and I was rather disconcerted by this divorce. And I thought, if I'm chair, I won't have much time to think about myself or my situation. It was a way of distracting myself.
Huh.
I knew how to do it. I'd been through it 3 years, so I knew the drill, I knew the calendar, and so that's why I did it. So it was a mixture of not wanting this other person and of using it as a kind of therapy for myself.
Tom, did the other candidate drop out once you announced that you were going to stand for chair?
The other candidate dropped out, and he and his wife went on the market and were gone 6 months later.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. They could no more stand me as chair than the department could stand them as a, that was another thing. They have this couple, both members of the department. One reason that having married people in the same department is a gamble. Because they go home and they reinforce each other's, you know, if they're really sort of irritable, paranoid people, they go home and reinforce each other's worst traits. And they begin to plot. And so it was then that I was given that compliment of having the best thing I had done as chair was to help remove these people from the department. So the second chair.
Yes.
The second 3 years, really two events, two extended events, but two activities. One was, there was a guy from the foundation named Robert Lang, who came to my office, and I think he had talked to Dean Certain, if I recall. And I think the dean and Bob had agreed, or the dean had said to Bob, see if you can get a board of visitors started with English. And maybe you can correct that if I'm wrong about it. But I had this, it was a clear sense in 1996, and even at the end of 93, 94, 95, 96, it was 98 when I was chair for the second time, because I finished up in 96, that the university was now going to have to go to a kind of public-private model for funding. It was going to have to get its money not only from the state, but also from fundraising. And, you know, the chairs, every year there's a Associated Departments of English conference for chairs of English departments. And there are the same kind of organizations for chancellors. And I, you know, this was happening all over the country if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education. Public-private, private-public cooperation and combination. This was the buzzword. This is the way we're going to make it in the 21st century. Because that, I mean, the way I see it, you know, the Republican revolution had succeeded by that time. And no one, Democrat or Republican, was willing to raise taxes or beat the drum for public education and that kind of thing. So it had to be public-private. And I think Phil, I'm guessing, maybe you can confirm this, Phil decided that some of the major departments should have their own fundraising board of visitors.
What I can confirm is that Phil identified English as one of the major departments that the foundation should be focusing on.
Yeah.
Because of the significance of English.
Okay.
English was important, history was important, chemistry was important.
Yeah.
There were, and Phil basically identified those without telling the foundation what to do, but in the departments that I had, English and history were, you know, key.
Key,
you know,
sure.
So that had the dean's endorsement.
Yeah, all right. So Bob Lang showed up, and a very likable guy, and impressed upon me that English department had over 11,000 living alumni, and that a good many of them had loyalties to the university and to their major, had fond memories of their time at Wisconsin and their teachers in the English department, that there was a chunk of them that were very likely possible donors, and that the English department, if I was willing to do it, should set up a board of visitors that would meet twice yearly, and should also establish a newsletter that would go out twice yearly. And Until that time, the chair had written a letter at Christmas and in June, usually a 3 or 4 page single space letter, and sent it out to certainly to those people who had contacted the department. We didn't send it out to 11,000 people, I'll tell you that, nothing close to it. Mm-hmm. Maybe 50 people or 150 people. And we would get back maybe somewhere between 5 and 10,000 a year at the most. Mm-hmm. Bob suggested to me that we travel around the country and meet with prospective board members and ask them whether or not they would be willing to serve on the board. Well, I actually am a very sociable person. The idea of going to Chicago, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Santa Cruz, New York, and talking to extremely successful people in the work that they had chosen to do sounded like fun to me. Now, I think there probably were faculty members who felt that I was, you know, that fundraising was beneath the faculty's, you know, purview, that faculty shouldn't be soiling their hands with money. I never heard anybody talk about it or denigrate it in just those terms, but there was a sense that I got from a few faculty members. But most people realized that this could be a very good thing.
Generally, Tom, was the department supportive of the concept of a board? Or were
absolutely
they...
We wouldn't have done it if they hadn't been. It was one of my principles as chair that you develop support for things you want to do from the department. That you just can't go ahead and do things unless you have a broad base pyramid beneath you. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have some dissent, but you have to have a good majority. Otherwise, you're not acting on behalf of the department, and you just cannot maintain a healthy atmosphere in a department if you're just going off doing what you want to do, thinking that it's in the best interest of the department, but you're not giving them any input into it. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. So at least I didn't think you could do that. So we did have a meeting. I don't know whether I told you about it, but we did have a meeting. This was brought up, and I got an overwhelming majority. Well, go for it. If you think you can raise some money for the department, we're all for it. So then Bob and I did not go to Minneapolis, but we went to Chicago. We went to, what was that, Forest, River Forest or Forest, you know, the suburb of Chicago.
Tom, I've forgotten.
Yeah, good for you. And we went to San Francisco and met with a guy who was high up in Hasbro Toys.
Oh, yes.
Remember him? Very good guy. Don Gibbs.
Yes.
And then we went down to Santa Cruz and talked to a woman who started her own business. And remember meeting Sally Mead Hands.
Sally Mead Hands, who was already supporting the department,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes.
Had created a BASCM, hadn't
she? Yes,
she
had. I think for Joe Wiesenthal.
Okay.
I think that's right. And because Joe had gotten to know her earlier. And, we met Fred and Goffin. What was his first name? Bill Goffin. Both of whom were lawyers. Big-time lawyers, you know.
That's right. We did. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Fred had been an 18th century scholar. And asked Quintana. That's the guy I was trying to remember the other day.
Yes.
And Quintana had said, you know, I think you'd do better by going into law. You know, you're so particular and literal about things. Something like that. I don't remember exactly how it went, but Bill and Fred and Sally were enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
I always saw myself as I always used to think of myself as the color man. You know, you were the guy, you represented the foundation, and you had the wording to make it clear what we were doing here.
Yes.
And I was the color man. I was the charisma, such as it was. to get people interested in English. I would show interest in them. We would talk books. And they tended, as a group, to be flattered to have the chairman of the English department come visit them and be willing to talk with them. I remember meeting Peter and Susan Straub at their townhouse in New York City. And that was great fun. And we met the guy who was at the time, the chief operating officer for Time, in New York Times? The financial officer?
Yes. What was his name?
Yeah, I've forgotten his name.
Lance.
Yes, it was Lance.
Lance Primus?
Primus. Very good, Bob. And that was interesting. We did not manage I guess he was just too busy, but it was fun to meet these people in their different lines of work and to try to make, I always felt that one of my virtues was that I'm able to make contact with people. Mm-hmm. Some sort of personal genuineness, sincerity, that just seems to be something I've inherited.
Tom, I've forgotten. Did you meet with Carl Gerassi, or was that just Ron Wallace?
Well, that was just Ron Wallace, but I became involved in that.
Okay.
And went to a number of breakfasts with Carl and so on. I'm sure he wouldn't remember me from Adam. That was largely, he was primarily interested in creative writing,
uh-huh.
and Ron was running that particular end of things. And then it might have been in the second year Joe Bennett. You brought Joe Bennett. Bennett was here for a football game. Remember Joe? And Joe?
I think I had left by that time.
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so, Bob. You had cultivated, you had a long interest with him, and it was his wife, Jean Wall, who had been an English major here. Joe Bennett had not been. But Joe wanted to do something in honor of his wife.
Oh, yeah.
And we talked with him about, his wife, Jean Wall, had been especially, enjoyed American literature and the American literature professors that she had. And so I suggested, why don't we set up something for a gift for the Jean Wall Bennett Fund that would help our graduate students in American literature and that we would use eventually to help establish an American Studies program. Well, he liked that idea, and you know who it was in the room? It was not you. I'm sure you knew Joe, but it was another guy who had been following Joe for a number of years.
Probably.
I cannot remember his name. Yeah. But a week or so later, we got our first big gift of $250,000 from Joe Bennett. And at that point, there was no one in the department who questioned the value of this endeavor. And it really has helped us bring some superb American scholars here, and we have got the beginnings of an American Studies program going.
Really?
Yes. So it's just within the department, because the politics of it across campus are just intractable. So.
I'm sure.
Yes. So so that was one thing. And then, we had these meetings in the fall and in the spring. It was quite a challenge for me. But you helped me work up an agenda, and then subsequent people from the foundation after you moved over to the, Wisconsin
Academy.
Humanity, the Academy, became director of the Academy. And I always had to have some help putting together an agenda. How do you fill the day with something other than, write me a check, for God's sake? So at first it was sort of obvious that the first thing to do was to educate them about the English department.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been your idea to bring in some really bright undergraduate to speak to them. And I had a graduate student give a little 15-minute presentation. And we would go down and we spent, I remember, spend maybe a half an hour in the writing lab with Brad Hughes. And some of the people got very excited about Brad Hughes and about the Writing Fellows program and began to provide money for that program.
This concludes side two of tape 9.
This is tape number 10, side 1, Tom Schaub, December 21st, 2006. So Tom, you were talking about the Board of Visitors and setting the agenda.
Yes,
has it worked?
It has worked. I could go into greater detail about all this, but the upshot of it is that I did this for 3 years with the board, and then Susan Friedman took over and somehow brought the board to the next step, which you had said would happen, whereby the board began to set its own agenda and began to operate as a body that was working on behalf of the English department. Mm-hmm. And some members have dropped out or been rotated out. Others have joined. I've forgotten now what the total endowment is that we have now, but I think it might be over 10 million. I'm not sure yet.
Wonderful.
To tell you the truth, but Susan did a great job with the board, moving it into its next sort of stage as a self-operating unit that communicated among itself. Mm-hmm. Members communicate among themselves. They assign each other tasks. There'd be subcommittees that work on.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so it's
great.
It's working very well. And Mike Bernard Donalds, the current chair, has continued that, and I think done a good job with it. Some of the people I've been sorry to see leave, like I think Bill Goffin has left now, and in Marilyn from Milwaukee. I've forgotten her last name. Marilyn Taylor. Geez, I really enjoyed her. You know, she was a poet,
mm-hmm.
and so she really enjoyed the English department, and she and I corresponded somewhat about, you know, she'd send me copies of her newest books of poetry. She was really quite a good poet, mm-hmm. very good poet. So I developed a very personal attachment to most of these people.
Yes.
And
could we just let the record reflect that you actually did develop good relationships, Tom? It was fun traveling with you, and and you were very good. You know, not all chairs are good with donors.
Yeah.
And you were good with it. It was fortuitous, I think, for the English department.
Yes.
That you happened to be chair when the dean was moving us ahead mm-hmm. on the public-private partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, it could well be. Could well be. I remember Susan saying to me, you know, they always try to get me to show up for the dinner. And Susan saying to me, you know, they really like you. It's like, you know, where's Tom? Because I don't know, I was interested in them, I liked them, and they reciprocated. So
is the department still supportive of the work of the board?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they've had a major impact on our graduate program, allowing us to provide PA ships. Now, as a result of the board, and perhaps as a result of some other negotiations with the graduate school, we are now able to offer funding of some sort for almost every first-year student. And that is a huge difference, because it
wow.
used to... Yes.
Really? You had that for your graduate students?
Yes. It used to be that we lost out to so many schools because we could offer them a great package from their second year on, but they had to sort of go into debt to get their master's degree. And then when they went into the PhD program, we had TA ships and other kinds of like a PA ship, project assistance, and
mm-hmm.
so on, that they could use to fund their schooling. But now we have PA ships and some outright fellowships and things that we're able to offer to graduate students. And we're still losing the battle with some of the very best students. We're rarely getting our top five or sometimes even our top eight picks. You know, they go to Yale or Harvard or Princeton or because they get some fat recruitment packages.
Mm.
Even Iowa, University of Iowa, took one of the people that we wanted. The guy got $25,000 a year plus having his tuition paid. Well, you know, that's at the moment out of Wisconsin's league. But the fundraising, the Board of Visitors has been an extraordinary thing, Bob. And, you know, your name ought to be on a plaque somewhere in the English department. So, you know, because we have a lot to thank you for. You were very well liked by these people.
Oh, good.
They looked forward to seeing you. And so in any case, that was one major element of the second term. The other was there was more money around to hire. And there was money of two kinds. There was money that was controlled by the dean of the college, because you see, under the restrictions that had taken place in the first, sort of at the end of Crawford Young's year and the early years of Phil Certain, there was no money. And I don't know whether it must have been the system. Or maybe it was Madison that lost 400 positions. I mean, we lost a ton of faculty.
It was Madison. It was 400.
Yeah. So that is a large percentage of faculty positions left unfilled. Most of that, probably all of it, was attrition. But you just weren't being given permission to hire. Mm-hmm. And so your numbers shrank. Well, we started getting more money in. Salary money started going up with better merit packages. And along with that, there was more money to try to repair some of the damage that had been done. Because the time to degree was going up. You couldn't get your students out of here in 4 years. You just didn't have the teachers. So, you know, there's a real consequence for cutting the university back, and that's one of them. Another is that you lose your best people, mm-hmm. and so on. So there was that kind of money from the dean. Then there was also money from the chancellor's office. The chancellor at this moment, David Ward, said it's time now to rethink, to sort of stir up the pot a little bit, and we're now going to hire, these are interdisciplinary hires. Mm-hmm. There would be money to hire people that would work in more than one department, that would help bridge, would help develop a horizontal community across and between the sort of stovepipe of each department. Mm-hmm. I can remember Ward saying to the chairs, you know, Madison has built a world-class institution by letting the departments build themselves. And we've done that great. But now it's time to cross-fertilize. Mm-hmm. It's time to develop a new model, or at least salt the earlier model with another dimension. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could call me an opportunist, Bob, but my feeling was this was something to get behind. Uh-huh. Not only because I had some sense that this was an interesting idea, but because if you're going to fill in gaps in your faculty, this is the only way to do it. Now there were many departments that said, no, we're not doing joint hires. We want a full FTE, full-time equivalent, in our department, teaching four courses. My feeling was, and I said this to the faculty, because we had members of our own faculty who felt that way, that this was not, you know, this is not the way the MLA hires people. It's not the way a Modern Language Association organizes its categories, its disciplines, and so on. And they fought this. But I said, look, so long as we have as our goal the hiring of superb faculty members, I felt that the gamble would be worth it. If we're looking for the very best people to fill these interdisciplinary positions, we'll be the winners. And in fact, over 3 years, I hired 17 people.
Oh my God.
Yeah, 17 people.
Not all. Joint appointments?
Not all joint appointments, by no means. Majority of them were people hired right out of LNS. We hired it, we went from having no assistant professors to having 12. We hired people at the full professor level with Tiefenthaler money. Yeah. We kept Lowenstein with Tiefenthaler money. We got Terry Kelly from UT Austin, Texas, and made her a Tiefenthaler professor in Romanticism. We hired Sarah Geyer from Oregon to pair up with Terry, and she's been gangbusters. She's been a tremendous scholar. See, who else did we hire at the... Oh, we got Jack Niles from Berkeley. Now, that was fortuitous because his wife took a job here in the French department.
Oh.
And so Jack took a golden handshake, I think, out of Berkeley and then continued his career here. But he's probably the top guy in the world in Beowulf. And he's in our English department.
Really?
Yeah, and he just won a Whorf professorship. He's continued to publish. He's gangbusters. A great colleague. So we hired at the very, you know, we hired full professors, we hired associate professors, we hired assistant professors. And we went from about 38 faculty all the way up to about 53, 54.
That's amazing.
Yes, and Susan has added more. And I think Mike has managed to hire one, maybe two people. Mike is... came aboard as chair during a drought. But there was money in those years when I was second term chair. And I said, I'm not overhauling any program. I'm not tinkering with the department. The only thing I'm doing this year is raising money and hiring people. And I kept my eye on that.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of departments didn't. And they wanted this to happen. And I got behind it. And boy, I made hay.
And which departments did you work with for joint hires?
Well, Susan managed to hire, Susan Friedman at that time, managed to hire Rob Nixon and Ann McClintock. I think Ann McClintock is half women's studies, half English, and Rob Nixon is half English, half environmental studies. We worked with, let's see, somebody in anthropology, South Asian studies. We've got somebody here who teaches Asian Indian literature in translation. It's, Rushdie is Indian, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she's also got an appointment in other parts of the university.
Tom, when you do those co-hires, is one of the departments considered the home department?
The tenure home, yes.
The tenure home.
Yes. And they're a bear, you know, because you got to work with the other department. This candidate, poor candidate, has got to go through the mill of both departments, got to be loved and dined and wined, and, you know, and then they have to go up to see the dean and sometimes two associate deans. So it was a ton of work. But we really came out on top of that. And our ranking with the National Graduate Record or something that does these anyway, we went from like 23 down to 16.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in fact, your tenure as a department leader has resulted in the department regaining some of its stature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we brought Teju Olayan from Virginia University. You know, that's a peer university. It's an extraordinarily good English department. We got him to move here as a full professor. And he's a native Nigerian, I believe. And we hired Shireen Sherard from Cornell University as an assistant professor, who is an African-American and works in African-American turn of the century and modernist work. I mean, you know, these are people that are difficult to recruit because everybody wants to have the advantages of scholars with different backgrounds.
Yes.
And we hired Shireen's husband, Ahmad, is a national prize-winning poet who's now in our creative writing department. With, you know, a black male creative writer is just, you know, scarcer than hen's teeth.
Right.
And he's terrific. You know, these people are you know, Shireen is a wonderful Americanist. So we ended up hiring an African-American. We hired a Native American. We hired two Asian-Americans. You know, so the department diversified itself dramatically. You know, it had been one of the departments for a long time that had a relatively equal balance between men and women. But of those, you know, with those 17 hires, we dramatically diversified the department, which is a very good thing for students and colleagues alike. And we still had Nellie McKay at that time, so we had gangbusters, African-American courses and seminars, and now we have three Native Americanists. So it was just, it could not have been more successful. I'm glad that I got a chance to be chair when there was a good deal more support from the state. And this cannot be overstated. Not only was there more money coming into Madison from the state, but we happened to work with the chair who felt, with the dean, who felt that the institution that he was in charge of, Letters and Science, could not be of great stature without a great English department. And we also had an associate dean, Jane Tylus, who was a literature person, who felt the same way. She was from Comp Lit and French and Italian. So it was a real, as you say, what a conjunction of the planets.
And you and Phil Certain got along.
We did. I really liked Phil. Yes, I did. I don't know how he felt about me, but I liked Phil. I respected his judgment. He was a guy who was willing to do, to make strong statements. He was willing to do. I remember when we tried to hire Simon Jocondi from Michigan, and I said, you know, we could use this special, you know, minority hire money, and Phil said, I don't think we want to use that money for Jocondi. I think he deserves a professorship all on his own. You know, I mean, he was an inventive and creative guy. He would make decisions. I have a suspicion, I don't know if this is true, but I felt that English got a fair share of the spoils during those years, and I'm sure other departments did as well. But I don't think he felt it was necessary to dole the money out equally around the university. And some deans maybe feel that pressure.
I just, to reference what we were saying earlier, it was Phil, it was not me and it was not the foundation, it was Phil who identified to the foundation that English needed more attention.
Yeah.
And he did that for other departments as well. Mm-hmm. And departments that he was not interested in, he would suggest that perhaps the foundation not spend any time in those areas.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, history and English, political science, I suppose mathematics, economics, chemistry, I mean, these have to have the large alumni lists.
It was interesting about Phil. He identified chemistry as an important area, and I think he was willing to take the criticism of, oh, sure, you pick chemistry because you're a chemist.
Yeah.
I don't think that was it. I think it was because chemistry is important and it was a strong department.
Absolutely. I agree. I think Phil was just, he was wonderful for the College of Letters and Science. And you know, we all were sorry that he retired. He was tough. I remember having a battle with him in the dean's office. Had something to do with the number of students we were teaching had been going down, and he was looking at it from the standpoint of student hours, and I was looking at it from the standpoint of faculty filling, teaching classes. And so I showed him my numbers, and he kind of went like this and scratched his chin. He says, well, wait a minute, let's look at it from this point of view. He went at it from got his out of his calculator. I remember, too, that second stint, I was up there in the dean's office, and he was saying how, I think I said to him, I recognize that you have limits on the amount of money that you have available to help out the departments in your college. And he interrupted and said, but that's not going to keep you from asking me for all of it, is it? And I said, well, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't, would I? And he said, well, I guess not, you know. So we had a pretty good understanding, I think. For all I know, he thought I was a pain in the neck. I don't know, but...
He didn't. Yeah. He liked what you did, from my perspective, that we got our Board of Visitors up and going.
Yes.
You know, that was the most he and I ever talked about you,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he had to look after the whole
sure
college. But he noted that the board was up.
Yes. Oh, good. Yeah. Well, it's, I think in the long run, in the not too distant future, if we now have Jacques Lesser coming in next year as the chair, and he's a tremendous, tremendous speaker and very personable, very professorial, but very genial about it, and I have a sneaking suspicion he'll be very good at talking to the board and the deans and graduate school and trying to get the funding that we need to be competitive.
Tom, do you think you'll ever be chair again?
I don't think so. It occurs to me now and then I could have run this year, but I think it's good for the department to have a rotation of chairs. I think I was the only chair, except for Joe Wiesenfarth, in the history of the English department, in the modern English department, that had been chair more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I had left my imprint on the department, and that was enough. And I'm working up toward another book. I find myself being sucked back into and starting to get interested in this and that. I mean, it's strange how long it takes to get back into a kind of research head. I mean, those two chairmanships, the divorce, loss of my brother, and my two parents all took place.
What happened to your brother?
He died of a heart attack.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. I didn't
well,
know.
Well, happened in 92, summer of 92.
Oh.
And... you know, that was sort of right out. It was a little bit like Ted Williams, you know, having to fight in both World War II and the Korean War. I was just blown out of the water. And but I've got this Approaches to Teaching Pensions now being copy edited, and that'll come out from the Modern Language Association. And now I'm thinking about I'm beginning to think about what it means to write literature that is critical of the social and political history of the United States. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when you read critical, what I call critical patriotism of the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
you're reading literature written at a time when the United States is pivoting into the modern world,
mm-hmm.
Particularly with things like the invention of things like the Limited Liability Corporation, which goes to the Supreme Court and is decided in cases and becomes a person in its own right that limits the liability of its board,
mm-hmm.
Its employees. And the corporation goes on forever. There's no, the corporation doesn't die unless it loses its market share, or its audience, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense there that the United States is taking a wrong turn. That things could be recuperated, a different sense of what being an American could be and what a nation it could be was still possible. By the time you get to Dos Passos, he's absolutely disenchanted with the rise of advertising, mm-hmm. promotion, in-house stock dealing, what is it called, inside trading, particularly dismayed by the power of the media and to create and mold citizens' opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So that the whole bedrock of the republic in its voting you know, you think, well, we vote for our representatives. Well, that doesn't work if the voters are not getting straight dope. Mm-hmm. You know, and this was a big issue in the 20s. Walter Lippmann wrote about it, John Dewey wrote about it, and it forms really the bedrock of that, of the USA trilogy that Dos Passos wrote about the United States.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and that's why you've got those newsreel sections.
Uh-huh.
And the biography sections, because you see, he shows how, in his view, good people like the Wright brothers continue to be interested in what they're originally interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people like Henry Ford, who is an American individualist, who's tinkering with the car and creates an engine and so on, and ends up having Gatling guns, machine guns, turned on his own workers.
Mm-hmm.
He shows the way in which corporation and the market, the way in which now the corporation has to answer to its stockholders, and what that does to the employees, and the speeding up, and the changing of the whole life of the worker.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you get that with The Jungle as well.
Yeah.
And then in the postmodern novel, in a book like Doctorow's Book of Daniel,
mm-hmm.
which came out in 71, I think, and then more recently, what's his first name? Anyway, somebody, T. Volman, V-O-L-L-M-A-N, comes out with a book called The Rifles, which is about the impact upon the Eskimo of the Northern Territories, above the Arctic Circle,
mm-hmm.
of the arrival of the explorers, people looking for the Northwest Passage, and their introduction of rifles into the territory, and what that does to them, what that does to their culture. William T. Volman, I think, and he has three different expeditions plus one contemporary one, which all sort of dream-like merge into one another. It's a marvelous, marvelous novel. But in Doctorow's novel, I'm talking about, you know, I was talking about the realist naturalist period and the modernist period, and then in the postmodern period, you have a character, Daniel, in the Book of Daniel, who thinks to himself, he quotes his father as saying, "And it's still going on, Daniel. It's still going on." And he's saying this with some contempt, that his father should have known better. Of course it's still going on. But that sense of, it's almost like, when I read that for about the fifth time, I put down in the margin of the novel, is this the gist of the American novel since the Civil War? It's still going on? And then in Volman's book, he says, the narrator speaks to the reader all of a sudden and says, "What good does it do for me to share this horror with you?" So as I'm thinking about, I think that's probably going to be the question that's generating my next book.
Hmm.
So I'd rather do that than be chair again, Bob.
At this point in your life?
Yeah, and I'm hoping that probably in the next couple of years, someone else would take over contemporary literature. Because I've done that for 17 years. And I don't know that I've pushed it further along. It was Larry Dembo who made the journal an international journal of high repute. And I think I've kept the stature of the journal. But, you know, it's had to deal with the fact that the profession's changed. It's no longer acute, intellectually persuasive and readings of books and poems and things that once French theory and sociology, anthropology began to enter into the ways in which we approach literature, I think the kind of things contemporary literature does has splintered off, or has become less the thing that the profession does.
Hmm.
So that now, if you have some sort of critical theoretical point to make about a contemporary book, you're more apt to write about the theory takes precedence over the fiction, and you send it to critical inquiry, or you send it to new literary history, or representation. So there have been a flood of new journals Now we still, as a journal, make money. We're still in the black. We have nearly 2,000 library subscriptions.
Really? How often does it come out?
4 times a year. It's a quarterly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you've been doing this all this time while you've been doing everything else.
Correct. Correct. And maybe if this had been my main focus, I would have, you know, one of my thoughts has been maybe one issue out of four ought to be contemporary literature and culture. You know, moving into this next category that's more, you know, what we've been doing more and more in the profession in literary study is our various forms of cultural studies. Mm-hmm. And yet there are hundreds and hundreds of people who, probably the majority of the profession, maybe not in the Research One institutions, are still teaching literature, and they see that as their main interest. Mm-hmm. And job. That's what they're hired to do. And so they find the journal. Some have written to me, say it's indispensable. It helps them keep up with what's happening now. And there are other ideas that I've had about the journal, but you know, Bob, there's only 24 hours in a day. So.
Well, I used to think that until I talked with you, Tom. You put more than 24 hours in a day.
So I think that's probably a good place to stop.
This concludes the oral history interview with the distinguished, the accomplished, and the very engaging Tom Schaub. Thank you, Tom.